Namaste and welcome to another episode of the Bharat Vartha podcast. I'm Roshan Karyapa. On this podcast, we have Dr. Albert Ningthaojong, who teaches at the Symbiosis School of International Studies and is an expert on West Asia. We're going to discuss India's relations with the region and why it could be significant going forward. So thank you, Dr. Ningthaojong, for being on Bharat Vartha. It's a pleasure to host you.
Thank you, Roshan, for having me here this afternoon to speak on a subject which is very important. From the Indian foreign policy point of view.
Actually, before we delve deeper into today's topic, I would love to understand, you know, how did you get interested in West Asia?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I never had, of course, all of us, whenever we talked about West Asia during our, you know, yesteryears, all we could think of was oil. The Gulf War, having born in the early 80s, saw a little bit of what happened during the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein was one figure all of us are very familiar with. And of course, certain news about Israeli-Palestinian conflicts, clashes, violence that we got to see on the television channels from time to time. Apart from that, I never had any interest, to be honest. Of course, maybe I was not exposed to the significance of this region then. But then it changed entirely in 2006-7 when I joined JNU for my master's program in politics with specialization in international relations. Over there also, I was pretty clueless about what electives should I go for, because you have fascinating topics like European foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, and there was one on West Asia, politics of West Asia, and I took that course, and I had another elective in my final semester, that is MA in Israeli foreign policy, which is still continued to be taught by Professor P. R. Kumaraswamy. So one, I have an overall introduction to West Asian politics, regional dynamics, security, geopolitical dynamics, and at the same time, I moved to something very specific, that is Israeli foreign policy. And then I started building up my interest on the region. Of course, my first priority was given towards understanding the Israeli foreign policy and how Israel has used arms sales as a diplomatic tool to promote its foreign relations with different countries in different parts of the world. But at the same time, over a period of my journey, research journey, I started looking at India's relations with West Asian countries. At the same time, the regional security dynamics, mostly to do with terrorism and how these countries are ramping up their security cooperation with different countries in different parts of the world, including India. So right from my MPhil, which began in 2008, since then, the journey continues till today. And while I looked at my specialization was on is on Israeli foreign policy and arms trade and its military cooperations with other countries, I have been looking into India's relations, as I mentioned, with some of the key countries, not all of them, with some of the key countries in the region, particularly apart from Israel, which is my area of specialization. Look into Saudi, UAE, Oman in the recent times, Qatar, Bahrain, And so, that's more or less how I can give a long explanation to them. That's not the purpose of this talk. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think, for most of us, when we speak of West Asia or, as we know it as the Arab world or the Middle East, we think of course, the Gulf War, we think of the Israel-Palestine conflict and so on and so forth, right? But could you give us a sense of, how these countries are perhaps similar and how they vary?
Yeah, it's a very interesting, region, because if you talk about West Asia, it's a huge expanse territorially. It's a geographical region that has been of great importance in history since ancient times. And of course, it is strategically located. It is a natural land bridge connecting the continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe. And now you have seen almost all the major powers from both the hemispheres, wanting to get closer to the region so that they have an easy access to our part of the world, Asia, and down south of the Middle East or West Asia, that is African continent. And that has also, given the connectivity towards the Mediterranean or the European region. So it was, the West Asian region was also the site of the world's earliest civilizations and birthplace of three great religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And of course, it is considered as the cradle of civilizations. you know, as the civilizations flourished due to presence of very important rivers like Nile, Tigris, Euphrates, and in Yemen also. So, but in terms of similarities and dissimilarities, you can see that quite well, very prominently in terms of how some of them are faring very well economically in terms of stability as well, and how some of them continue to remain very problematic or very sensitive. Say, for instance, countries like Yemen, you look at it, countries like Syria, and Iraq has been juggling between that, you know, good and bad and whatever you can think of. So in terms of the political economy of the region also, it is pretty, I would say, it doesn't have a very uniform pattern. You would see some of the monarchical regimes, particularly the Gulf countries, faring very well economically as compared to some of the countries in the hinterland like Iraq or Syria or Lebanon, for that matter, which is, of course, you must be following what's happening in Lebanon. It's pretty in a bad shape economically, security, politically. So there is this very unfair distribution of in terms of economy also. You know, you could see Yemen doing very bad, very poorly because of the civil war. And on the other side, you have UAE just in the neighborhood, one of the largest GDPs in the world. So you could see a variation of, you know, different characteristics. It would be, again, I would not be able to do justice in a few minutes to, you know, to give the similarities and dissimilarities. At times, it's very, you know, saddening to see countries like Iraq with large endowment of natural resources, you know, having to see lots of violence and destructions. And particularly look at countries like Lebanon on the Levant, on the eastern part of the western part of West Asia or in the Mediterranean. With that kind of you know, strategic location, it could have done wonders in terms of its connectivity with other parts of the world. But the internal political dynamics is so poor that, you know, it has not been able to harness the actual potential of the country's strategic location. So just to sum up, it would be, I would say that, you know, the dissimilarities and similarities of these countries are huge, while you can see a bit of a similarity in the pattern with the Gulf countries that are doing fairly well then, as compared to others. And you have very interesting countries like Israel on the other side, very advanced economically, technologically, militarily. So that's more or less a little bit about the similarities.
So a couple of the fault lines in this part of the world is the Saudi and Iran or the Sunni-Shia sort of a conflict. And the other is the Israel-Palestine conflict, which we talked about earlier, right? So could you give us a sense of, you know, how the countries are sort of split around these fault lines?
Yes, that's something, a concern in the sense, if that is to continue in that pattern for the for a foreseeable future, it could always give the you know, stability in question or uncertainty. There would always be uncertainty about the stability aspect of West Asia. The more we have this sectarian-based, you know, sectarianism or sectarian divide between, on the one side, you have Saudi-led countries or, you know, at least perceived to be led by Saudi, you have some countries like UAE, Bahrain, now teaming up with countries like Israel. On the other side, you have Iran, you know, which is closely working with countries like Syria, you know, Lebanon, and also started to, you know, have some influence inside Iraq in terms of political as well as security dynamics. So, but then, very interestingly, at this juncture, while we are discussing this right now, there are certain steps that have been made by countries like UAE, Saudi Arabia, to paper over the differences between they have with the Iranians. If somebody, of course, I'm sure many who would be following this podcast would be able to tell that, you know, in the last few months' time, there have been some serious discussions going on between UAE and the Iranian officials. And at the same time, signals are coming out from Saudi Arabia in terms of their willingness to streamline the differences that have been existing between Saudi and Iranians, or particularly Saudi and Iranians, following the execution of a Shiite cleric in January 2016. The diplomatic relations nosedive, and at the same time with UAE was part of the Saudi-led group that kind of imposed a blockade on Qatar in 2017. So all these factors have resulted in the widening of these gaps between these countries. And of course, you could see it from the prism of like sectarian divide. You could see it from the prism of geopolitical competition. You can also see it from the angle of Iran as a factor, you know, which keeps the region really divided. Certain signals are coming out, and that if that is going to be a very sustainable or a very durable sort of, or if it's going to result in a positive eventuality in terms of bridging the gaps, and we could expect some sort of a stability in the region. Stability in the sense that for now, of course, like apart from certain skirmishes like that we get to see in the maritime domain in terms of the attacks on the oil tankers or the Houthis from Yemen firing rockets into UAE and Saudi Arabia, which are lastly seen to be as the handiwork of the Iranians. If there is a consensus on both the sides, that is on both the parties, to cool down the tension or the temperature, it works well for us, for India, it works well for the region, and of course, for the international community.
So before we progress towards, you know, India's relations with these countries, right, this part has always been attractive to world powers, right? I mean, we saw, for instance, in World War One, the British and the French made it a part of their policy. And then you had the Gulf being a key part of American foreign policy with oil interests and so on. And today you see China, for example, making moves with the Belt and Road Initiative and so on and so forth, right? You know, how has that affected the dynamics of the region?
If you're talking about, the region, you rightly pointed out about the political security dynamics that existed during the Cold War period. It was not undoubtedly a large battlefield for both the blocs, the USSR-led bloc and the American-led bloc, capitalism and communism, trying to garner support from all the possible parties in the region to support their whatever ideological fight against one another. There you could see again, that was also partially one of the reasons why, you know, Indian government and some of the governments in West Asia did not have a very close political ties for a pretty long period of time because of the Cold War factor. But right now, from the early 70s onwards, if you see, you know, to take back a little bit to the early 70s onwards, the US has kind of a replaced as one of the strongest or most important extra-regional players in the region. USSR was not very much in the scene. While they were in the scene, but then you could see the prominence of the United States getting closer and closer to countries like Israel, Jordan, then of course, like other countries like Saudi. The region continued to be the battlefield for both these blocs for a very prolonged period of time. But after the fall of the Soviet Union from the early 90s onwards, like again, US already had paved its way to become the strongest player in the region. And after the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, it was, of course, the strongest ally for many of the countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. But then in the recent times, that has continued to be the pattern till about 2010s, early 2010s. And beginning from mid-2010s onwards, when we started suddenly seeing the rats of the terrorist organizations like Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, you had seen the Russians coming in to play some important role by particularly from the Syrian platform, using the Syrian platform. So as of today, there are lots of discussions about, you know, Russia trying to reassert itself as the regional power or the hegemonic power in the region. Of course, that is debatable in terms of the kind of a manpower, the kind of a political support or the military support or military dynamics as compared to the Americans. And this again began, I forgot to add one thing, this again began this question about the US interest or dwindling US interest in the region began sometime from early 2011, when Hosni Mubarak was stepping down from Egypt as a result of the Arab Spring that started right. In 2010. So that had put a lot of question on the intentions of or the policy objectives or intentions of the Americans. Are they willing to stay back in the region, outside the region, or are they taking a step back from being that regional security guarantor? So that kind of created lots of tensions between the Saudis and the Americans also. And that's the reason why you started, you know, seeing many of these, the Gulf countries in particular, moving towards the Asian continent, like, you know, China, towards India, looking for the partnerships. And that change in the geopolitical dynamics between the American administration and some of the West Asian governments also had facilitated the entry of Russia. Yeah. So it's but now again you touch upon China's Belt and Road Initiative and all that looms really large in the region. They very well know the fact that the region is a gateway to Asia, Africa, and Europe, which is very much within the radar of their Belt and Road Initiative objective. They started in 2013. So now, of course, the Russians are, kind of balancing its relations with Israel, with Iran, with Syria, as well as with the other Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, UAE. And at the same time, you could see the same pattern being followed by countries like China, while we can come to India's relations a little later. Yeah. But then, China is also kind of playing a very cautious role in terms of expanding its strategic footprints, economic footprints in the region.
So coming to India's relations with West Asia, right? Most of us are aware that, we're dependent on the region for our energy needs and also that a significant number of our people work in those countries, right? UAE and so on. But could you talk to us about, how West Asia is strategically important for India?
Oh, yes. Importance can be, Russian importance can be described from various angles. Again, the introductory remark that I've given about, the ancient significance, the historical significance of the region, the gateway to all the three continents could also be applied to us, the way how we look at the region. We already have, or often if you look at any write-ups, any research paper or books or any monographs, you would always start, even the MEA, Ministry of External Affairs documents pertaining to India and West Asia or India and any of the West Asian countries, we would always see the first line that historical linkages, civilizational ties, ancient, connectivity, connections, spice trade and others, maritime trade. That remains still very important. Of course, one cannot negate the importance of the historical accounts and the historical linkages between any, let alone India and West Asia, but you name any other region also. History plays a very important role. But in that history, you have strategic component, economic component, cultural, social-cultural component, people-to-people contact have been very strong. You also pointed out about the large workforce that continue to make their living and contributing towards the economic development programs in West Asia. That remains very, very strong binding factor, or rather a binding force between India and West Asian countries. But in terms of, again, if you talk about significance and importance, it's very visible the kind of importance given by the Indian government right now. Not to say that the previous governments didn't do much about it. We have had, of course, every government has their own policies to look at it. But then the visibility that we have begun to see in terms of our political connection, political ties at the top level, top leadership, became very prominent, very significant since 2014. When we have the BJP-led government in the country. Earlier, earlier the kind of political visits, it would be very rare for an Indian prime minister to visit to any of the West Asian countries. It would be at the level of, say, external affairs minister or any other energy minister or commercial minister. To my mind and to my assessment, that was a missing link. No matter, regardless of how strong you have an economic tie with a country A or B from the region, unless and until you have a political goodwill from both the sides, you will not be able to actualize the real potential of the partnerships. So we have begun to see that from 2014, latter part of 2014, from 2015, the traffic of high-level political visits. Sushma Swaraj was very active in the region, our late external affairs minister, and Prime Minister Modi had visited almost all the countries except few of them, conflict or problematic countries like Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq probably, yeah. But then his visits to these countries have kind of reinforced, the need to have much more serious collaborations and partnerships with the region. People-to-people contact is, of course, a very important dynamic of the relationship. But now we have seen a good amount of growth in, military security cooperation also. No longer it is the case that we talk about Indian workforce going to the Gulf countries. No longer is the case about remittances coming into our country annually from the Indian workforce living and working in the Gulf region no longer is the case about India, West Asia, energy, oil trade. It was very much transactional sort of relationship, but now there are lots of joint collaborations and both sides have been able to explore newer areas to establish further cooperation or partnerships in various fields. Apart from these three, economic, particularly trade, oil and energy trade, in the military sector, you can see a good amount of progress being made. Of course, with Israel, it's always been a very dominant component of the relationship, dominant characteristic of our foreign policy with Israel. But there are certain significant steps that have been taken by countries like UAE and Saudi Arabia in the recent times. And it is not only going to be a very seller-buyer sort of relationship, but there's going to be more of collaborations between defense industries. And of course, between security establishments in the non-traditional security sector, right? Radicalization, counter-radicalization, extremism, intelligence sharing and gathering, information sharing, extradition activities. So this is just to give you one of the, you know, and in, even in the health sector also, which I will come into later when we conclude the session. But yes, in terms of the political realignment that we are seeing in West Asia right now, within West Asia, Saudis, of course, talking tacitly with the Israelis, but you have a very big political breakthrough in 2020, that is the normalization of relations between Israel and UAE and Bahrain. This also would expand India's opportunities to explore for further cooperation involving these countries. Of course, we need to see in the future. That's the reason why I mentioned that, you know, the more we have a very stabilized West Asian region or West Asia, it's going to be to our advantage point. It's going to be beneficial for us, and that would also give a certain leeway to connect with other African countries and, you know, with the European southern part of European country also. Right. But the significance are very huge.
Yeah, we've always had cordial relations with the with these countries, right? And post 91, especially, I think a lot of trade has happened also. And we had the Look West policy as well. And since then, I mean, you mentioned, you know, a lot of significant developments have happened, especially post 2014. India and UAE recently, I mean, in fact, just this week, have signed the Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, right? I think one of those few trade agreements that we've had in a long time. What would you make of that?
Again, the discussion that we are having right now, you know, the signing of the Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement just yesterday during the virtual summit, I think puts this discussion into perspective, the significance of the region as well as India to both sides is complementary. Now, of course, the FTA that's been signed, it's a huge breakthrough for both the countries. But we should also be looking at. See, UAE is a small country as compared to, of course, any countries in West Asia. You compare with India, all of them are very small. So we also need to be mindful of the fact how much capacity would they be able to invest in our country. Of course, there are many investments going from the Indian side. So one should not really overhype the agreement. But it is, of course, a very, very important breakthrough in our partnership, because we have a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement with with UAE. And adding this, economic partnership agreement is a kind of adding another layer to the already thriving relationship, which is on the upward trajectory. This will, of course, open up a lot more investment opportunities for both the countries. We will have to see, because many a times there is also a perception that we are good in signing agreements with various companies or countries, or let alone the West Asian countries, but not much results are seen on the ground. But then to me, the juncture at which both these countries have signed this agreement is very important. While we are working unrelentingly towards improving our economic modernization programs, economic stability, economic security. At the same time, UAE also having a similar approach, not only with the UAE, but if you see the larger oil exporting countries in the region, in West Asia, they are moving towards non-oil energy, non-oil revenue sector, economic revenue sector, because of the fast depletion of this non-renewable sources of energy,
right,
which of course is a big source of revenue for almost all these countries in the region. So if you take any of these countries, let alone Saudi, let alone UAE, if you take any of these regional countries, they have their own vision programs, like economic programs, socio-economic reform program. As much as it is in Saudi Vision 2030, the UAE also has its own economic vision programs, into which they would want investments coming in as well as investments going out. So that's where, you know, the convergence of interest between India and the UAE lie. And signing of this, I haven't gone into the details of the agreement of yesterday, but I have seen what the representative from the UAE had to say, the Minister for Economic Affairs, I think. He hopes that, you know, there would be more investments, to and for investments going between the two sides. And at the same time, this could lead to further, you know, efforts towards having some sort of a joint venture in other countries. Again, Africa looms large. Southeast Asia, East Asia be another could be another region where, you know, India could work together with UAE. We already have a partnership with UAE in Ethiopia in building technological IT hub. So which is, of course, has its own strategic incentives as well as economic incentives. Similar approaches could be not only about investing in one another, but also investing in a joint investments in a third country. That would put our efforts towards having this multilateral or multilateral we talk about nowadays, plurilateralism efforts into perspective. So one needs to see how much of this agreement that's been signed, you know, would be utilized effectively on the and visible on the ground.
Right. So let's talk about the broader economic interest itself, right? And you mentioned a couple of things that I will delve into, right? Which is the fact that, you know, India has been growing, right? And investing in India will yield a greater rate of return for some of these countries. And the fact that they've been trying to hedge the oil economy, so to speak, right? I mean, they're, you know, with renewables, with shale, so on and so forth. So in that lens, right, I mean, when we look at infrastructure projects such as the North-South Corridor and so on, right, so what are the potential benefits of doing business in this region for the West Asian countries?
Well, the potential, you know, looms large. That's the reason why the Chinese government is everywhere. And if you compare our presence in the infrastructural project development that you just mentioned, we are a little lagging behind than the Chinese. Okay, because the Chinese, if you just do a bit of a search, it's huge, the presence in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf countries, or even in the Levant, in the other side of let's say in Turkey or Israel or Lebanon, for that matter, even in Syria, their presence are already there in terms of infrastructural development projects. And all of these projects, you know, have got to do with their BRI initiative, Belt and Road Initiative, land connectivity, air connectivity, railway lines, port constructions, you know, port development projects, electrification of railway lines, you name it. The Chinese are already there. And this is not to say that like the Indians are zero. We also have started to, in fact, in Syria, you know, to my mind, is a very good, very interesting case also. Before the country was shattered by the civil war, the unrest, we have quite a bit of our presence in the electricity, you know, field, you know, in power grid field. That is one thing, you know, which we could revive. You know, in 2018, when during Damascus Fair, there was a good Indian presence for both private-owned and public-owned companies. Of course, the Chinese were also there in big numbers, and we have been able to secure some projects in oil drilling, oil exploration, oil drilling facilities in Iraq and other West Asian countries, particularly in the Gulf. If you happen, you know, if you're talking about this infrastructural development projects, I would not still be able to say as much as I can be talking about the Chinese strategic footprint, because it's right. huge when compared to. So that is one area where we need to work upon. And that's the reason why, you know, stability in the region would be very, very important, because the more we increase our stakes, economic stakes, strategic stakes, we also need to be mindful of the security dynamics that exist in the region. The involvement of Indian oil companies in Israeli drilling and exploration and drilling in the northern part of Israel is a very significant development. I also wrote a piece recently on this energy dynamics of India-Israel relationship. But then, we have our own presence in terms of drilling and exploration in the energy field. That is, of course, in the crude oil and the other sector. But more needs to be done in this sector, in infrastructural projects.
So on our last podcast with Rashmini Koparkar, we spoke about the Central Asian republics and how they are important for us as a connecting route to Europe. And so West Asia plays a key role for us in our relations there as well, right? So could you describe that also in further detail?
Rashmini, my former colleague at Vivekananda International Foundation, and also my friend from JNU, she's spoken on that. The importance of Central Asia are similar, I think. Coincidentally, I would say that the emphasis being given towards both this region, Central Asia and West Asia, I think happened at the same time, around the same time when the government came in 2014. The importance of Central Asia, I'm not a watcher of Central Asia, but the region is a resource-rich region, which is very, very important for us, for our energy security, for our economic development programs and activities and growth programs. But at the same time, the security dynamics of the region holds importance for us. I would say that it would be kind of both the security, the dynamics of both the regions would have some sort of an impact indirectly or directly on one another. That is why we would again want to see a very stabilized Central Asia as well as a very stabilized peaceful West Asia. And in terms of our, again, the point that you talked about, connectivity and infrastructural projects and others, economic cooperation, the Chabahar Port Project and STC, the projects, the connectivity projects would give us lots of leeway to our initiatives to expand our economic and strategic footprints in Central Asian region. For that, we need to, first and foremost, we need to build up the trust between us and the Iranians. If you look at the India-Iran relationship in the last few years, it's been a little uneven. Mm-hmm. And it has always been uneven. I would not say that it has been very successful or very effective. We have our own shares of ups and downs with Iranians. The more we try to bridge that trust deficit between the two sides, the present government has been making some efforts again. That was very visible last year also, in terms of our foreign ministers reach out to the Iranians and they reach out to us. There are certain seriousness about bettering the relationship than how it is right now. And that would give us quite a bit of advantage to connect with Central Asia through trade and other connectivity projects. And of course, if you look at the recent phenomenon, what is happening right now, or the existing phenomenon, what is happening right now in Afghanistan, security coordination, intelligence sharing, information sharing, coordination are going to be one visible trademark in our relations, not only with the West Asian countries, but also with the Central Asian countries. So the security dialogue, the National Security Advisor Ajit Doval had with the Central Asian counterparts in the latter part of November last year was very timely and very significant because we need to have a very strong coordination between the security establishments of these countries in order to have a very nuanced understanding of what's happening inside Afghanistan, given the commonalities of borders between Afghanistan and the Central Asian countries. The close proximity between countries like Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan, for that matter. So we need to have a very robust security cooperation, not only in the traditional senses, but also in areas like cybersecurity, there is a visible, visible upgrade in the cybersecurity cooperation between India and West Asian countries, and that is the case with Central Asia also. You have SEO RATS, which is a very important platform to discuss the security dynamics.
Right. So you mentioned the Chaba port and Iran, right? I mean, we have been using the Dukung port in Oman, for example, right? And this is to strengthen our footprint in the Indian Ocean region. So from a defense and a military perspective, could you describe a little more of the strategic significance of this region for us?
Roshan, Oman, for that matter, has been the strongest defense partner for India for the last many years. And it's a beautiful relationship, the kind of equations being shared by, you name it, in the political realm or in the economic realm. People-to-people contact. The earlier king, who Sultan Qaboos, who expired, he had a very, very great fondness for India. That could be, that could be seen. That was well reflected in the nature of our cooperation with Oman. The strategic location, the geostrategic location of Oman, makes it all the more, very important for India to keep that momentum going on, or that equilibrium going on between the two countries. Facing the Arabian Sea, then you have some important, Gulf of Oman, then you have the Strait of Hormuz in a very close proximity. That has strategically raised the profile of Oman, if you're looking from the maritime security point of view. And of course, geostrategic significance of the country. For India, Oman is, as I mentioned just a while back, the nature of our defense security cooperation with Oman is very effective, robust, comprehensive, not only mere exchange of military officials or cadets going and coming. The frequency of the military exercises in the maritime domain also talks about the significance of military security cooperation with Oman. And the Oman's naval chief was in Delhi just a few days ago. So that talked about enhancing defense cooperation in the maritime domain. But at the same time, they are also discussing the possibility of having some defense industrial cooperation, which is very timely for us right now, because we are looking towards exporting our defense products to different countries. Oman was probably the earliest countries that received NSAS from us some years ago. And then they have their own technical issues and other aspects which stymied the level of the trade. But as we are augmenting our own industrial units and also looking forward towards exporting certain items, Oman looms very large. And it would not be, again, because we are giving lots of emphasis on self-indigenization, Atmanirbhar Bharat project, Make in India project. So we would be looking towards more of partnerships in developing and manufacturing certain military items or in other realms as well. So Oman is, from the defense angle, the maritime is very important. It's a very important country for us. If you look at the traditional nature of cooperation, it's very significant. And it could be of having a very good access to the agreement signed in 2018 February, I think, with Oman with regard to Dukung port access. That is a very important landmark agreement for us. That would, in times of crisis also, we would be having certain accessibility, having an accessibility to access to Dukung port would lessen some of our, maneuverability with regard to, say, evacuation process or any other, surveillance can be, improved. Because the reason, the maritime security dynamics in West Asia, particularly in the Strait of Hormuz region or in the Red Sea area, are a little concerning. Mm-hmm. So if we have some presence over there, we have seen hardships during evacuations in the early 90s during the first Gulf War. We had seen lots of efforts being made towards the evacuation process in 2015 from Yemen, Libya. So if we have more naval presence or that sort of an agreement with a country from the region, that would give us certain advantage in times of crisis also. So we need to look at both the angles, like overall, you know, advantage, and at the same time, in times of crisis, how we can utilize those port for our naval ships. Yeah.
Right. So since the 1950s, post the oil boom, there's been this rise of Wahhabism, right? And also, I mean, we have seen the rise of Islamic State and other terror groups and so on and so forth. And, you know, I mean, do you expect that the Indian government will do something regarding that, specifically in cooperation with some of the West Asian countries?
Well, yes. I briefly touched upon that 2014, the landmark. That year is very important because we saw the growth of ISIS, not only, of course, first it was in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria, taking over large swaths of territories, augmenting its own financial clout, its logistical clout. At the same time, it was able to garner a considerable amount of support from different parts of the world, including our country. I remember there was a time, 2014, was a very crucial period for the new, it was a big challenge for the new government that just came into the formation, that 46 Indian nurses were kidnapped, and I think 31 or I forgot the number, 46 Indian nurses and 39 workers were kidnapped in Tikrit and Mosul respectively. That was a big awakening for the Indian government in terms of our human security, the dynamics of human security. We already seen our, difficulties in the early 90s when we had the Gulf War evacuation. But then a kind of a kidnapping or, of that nature of 46 and 39 in 2014 was a big security challenge for us. And that incident had triggered a good amount of efforts from the Indian government side to strengthen the security cooperation with some of the major players, including particularly Saudi Arabia and UAE. I remember my former director, the former Indian Army Chief, General N.C. Bich. I was working under him at the Vivekananda International Foundation in New Delhi, and he gave me this assignment to look at only the growing influence of ISIS in South Asia, particularly in India. So when I started doing my research, when I started writing about it, there were quite a few who would try to not ridicule, but minimize the or lessen the importance of this terrorist outfit in our part of the world, saying that we will not see much of impact. But then we have seen quite a few activities in our country as well. The numbers could be very less if you compare to some of the fighters coming from Southeast Asia, Central Asia, or northern part of Africa towards Iraq and Syria to fight in the ranks of ISIS. The Indian numbers were less. I agree with that. But do we have to go by the numbers only? We also need to factor in quite a bit of other connections, that has been going on between our youth in India and at the same time ideologues or promoters of such very pernicious ideology sitting somewhere in UAE or Saudi or Iran or Iraq or Syria, for the matter, as an example. So that has given a good food for thought to the Indian government to scale up the level of our cooperation. I remember in 2014, during this kidnapping crisis, there was a mission of the security advisor, national security advisor to Iraq. And then we had our former IB chief, Asif Ibrahim, who was also a special envoy to PM on counterterrorism, he was being sent to Riyadh to open up some sort of coordination channel or information sharing, intelligence sharing channel. So that has given a good amount of reason for India to scale up the cooperation in the security domain, which was lying a little dormant, apart from the conventional exercises and others. So then onwards, we had seen quite a bit of to and fro discussions with regard to countering radicalization, countering violent extremism and radicalization and terrorism using cyber domain, because ISIS, of course, you know, internet was not first used by ISIS, like Al-Qaeda had already done that earlier also. But then ISIS has reinforced, you know, or has given rise to quite a few, you know, interesting techniques to use social media tools to work in their favor. So we started giving lots of importance towards augmenting our own cybersecurity infrastructure. And if you see, Roshan, if you see in almost all the discussions right now with these countries, with the governments in West Asia, cybersecurity component looms very, very large, looms large. And it's a very, very important discussion between CERT of India and CERT of the, you know, the regional CERT of those countries. Be it with Jordan, be it with Oman, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Israel, for that matter, Iran, Iraq. This component has become a very important or a very salient characteristic of our security cooperation. So that particular phenomenon being created by ISIS during that period of time sent a good amount of signals to us to be on guard. And now ISIS could have been, you know, might have been defeated territorially, financially, logistically in Iraq and Syria, but the kind of examples, the kind of you know, the kind of message it has sent out to like-minded people operating from some part of the world, you know, still the resonance still remains. Okay, so one has to be careful about the tactics they have promoted in terms of radicalization, recruitment. So one needs to be very careful about it. So for that matter, coming to your question about our cooperation or what can we do about it, what the Indian government is doing. So apart from this traditional nature of military security cooperation, that cybersecurity cooperation, you know, exchanges of best fit practices to tackle these problems are on the rise. And India has a very good, you know, working, you know, cooperation with Hedaya Center in the Abu Dhabi based Hedaya Center that looks after extremism, violent extremism, radicalization, SAWAP Center. We are also closely coordinating with Al-Azhar University in Cairo in Egypt. And similar tactics, similar approaches are visible with our interactions with Saudi and other West Asian countries also.
Right. So West Asia is also important from a China and a Pakistan perspective, right? And of course, I mean, both these countries have been making their own moves in the region as well. China, we mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative earlier, and Pakistan has the whole global Islamic alliance angle as such, right? So how does India's relation, you know, with these countries pair vis-a-vis China and Pakistan?
Oh, yes, that's an important question. See, we are, if you look at the current or the emerging dynamics, the political dynamics in West Asia, as I mentioned in my introductory remark, the relationship was not attaining that, you know, real potential or not reaching that real potential because of certain regional factors, internal factors, international factors, and Cold War was one of them, wherein you can bring in the Chinese factor, the Pakistani factor also. For some years, some decades, I would say, Pakistan was one important factor to keep India and West Asia a little bit away from one another. But then if you see in the recent years, that trend is fast changing, okay? So you have more to gain by aligning with countries like India, which is doing economically, technologically, politically well, and in terms of stability also, than to be only formulating your Indian foreign your India policy by looking at our relationship, our, in the sense, the West Asian countries, our relationship with Pakistan. So Pakistan, to my mind, has become less of a significance or less of a diminution. It's a diminishing factor from blocking India and West Asian countries to move forward. And Pakistan very well knows this. Why, you know, Sushma Swaraj was being called in to, you know, chair one of the OIC, to speak at the OIC. So that was done by the UAE, and that kind of ticked off the Pakistani establishment. But then they very well know that, you know, that's the reason why you could see this, you know, the close proximity between China and Pakistan in the recent years. At the same time, the kind of economic debt they have, the Pakistanis have vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, is huge. So you can't forever go on like that, you know. taking loans and not being able to pay on time, but still expecting some support from that, you know, lender to you. But then to my mind, Saudis, say, for example, Saudis, UAE, or any of the countries, they have more to gain by aligning with India than to criticize India openly in all the aspects. That's not going to be the case. See, from time to time, you might have some statements coming out which is not being in favor of our country, and the government would, you know, reprimand or, you know, calling the ambassador for explanation.
Yeah, I think there were a few statements said against the CAA, for example, right?
Yes, yes. But that's not going to, that purely ideological driven component of the foreign policy is kind of a diminishing, okay? It's all about real politics in the real sense now. Like how much I will gain strategically from my national interests. Look at, like, you know, who would have thought in Israel would normalize relations with UAE or Bahrain? It's all about, like, what one would gain from the other. Iran is not the only factor for the normalization. There are much more beyond that. So same thing with us. So this, while we are having our very speedy or an upward trajectory in our relations with West Asian countries, you can see on the other side, China and Pakistan also. And you can very well see how the Chinese are treating the Pakistanis also. Right. They have no choice. They have no, they don't have the luxury as much as we have to say that, like, what you're doing is not acceptable to us. And they will stop all the funding, military funding, assistance, economic funding, and assistance, and whatnot. But then certain countries cannot do that with us because we are rising, you know, in terms of our profile, economic profile, military security, political profile.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the point that you mentioned is so important because even with the Article 370 that happened, right? I mean, I don't think any of the countries said anything, much to Pakistan's, you know, protest.
That's, you know, that's something the Pakistanis could not digest.
Yeah.
Okay. And how would they use it? They would use it by getting closer to the Chinese or pricking the Indian population. Fringe elements, I would say, they could influence. But then, Roshan, you know, I think all of them are, as long as there are no physical harms or any such activity, diplomatic or political activity that could derail or that could puncture the trust level between us. I don't think, you know, we would regard those. Of course, we would be sending out our displeasure. And we also have reached that, you know, confidence to say to you that, you know, this is not acceptable to us and you need to think over it. So I think we have reached that kind of may not be in the absolute sense, but then the comfort of telling the other partner that, you know, this is our internal affair, this is our internal affairs, you may not. So that I think that would be the pattern which we will see for a foreseeable future. It's all about unless and until tomorrow you have a purely ideologically driven foreign policy initiatives from all the sides, like something left and right and not being able to find some convergence. But then I don't see that happening anytime soon.
So one of the things we've noticed post-COVID is a lot of multilateral alliances being formed, right, with Quad and so on and so forth. In that realm of, you know, alliances and possibilities, what do you think an India, USA, Israel, UAE, Quad kind of an alliance can achieve tangibly?
Right. That's, again, another very hot topic which is going on, which has been going on ever since our foreign minister visited Israel, and they have this West Asia Quad Summit, virtual summit involving the American leader, UAE, and Israeli leader. You're right. Health is going to be the discussion that we had briefly last night. Health is going to be one area, healthcare and, you know, medical and healthcare is going to be one area which is going to be given due importance. We already have our mechanisms, like, you know, official institutional agreements have already been signed by India. I remember Jordan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE. I think even Kuwait also, or all of them have their own framework, official framework, MOUs being signed to work together towards bettering the, you know, human security, health facilities, medical facilities. This is going to, of course, you know, COVID has reinforced the need to have a very robust partnerships between the regional countries, international players, and of course within the region or within a country also. And this merger of normalization of relations between Israel, UAE, Bahrain, and now you have this, within quotes, the West Asia Quad, mini Quad. It should open up a lot more avenues for multilateral or trilateral cooperation. We already see, we already have an existing coordination in place between Israel, UAE, and India in the renewable energy sector that began sometime last year. I think May, if I'm not wrong, May, in the month of May or something, there's some agreement being signed. And now, apart from this Russian healthcare sector, technological realm is another field. Technology is another field or realm where you can see certain forward movements involving all these countries. When you talk about technology, it can be in the field of defense and security. It can be in the field of climate. It can be in the field of energy. So there is a growing emphasis being given by all the countries: India, Israel, UAE, Saudi, Bahrain. If you're talking about this Abrahamic Accord, and including India's, prospects and challenges, opportunities, renewable energy sector is one which is going to be where we can see some sort of a development. All these countries are giving certain very significant attention towards generating solar-based energy. Israel has its own objectives to reach by 2030 some megawatt, as much as the Indian Prime Minister keeps talking about going back to or relying more on renewable sources of energy for ourselves. Bahrain has shown some interest towards that to collaborate with India. And of course, UAE, I just read the news by it yesterday that energy sector was one that has been given a push from the economic partnership, apart from the trade, the conventional trade. Energy was one area, and clean energy, green energy. So you would expect to see some trilateral or quadrilateral coordination between these countries in these sectors. Economic is one, looms large. Economic is very much there.
There's also space research and stuff, right?
Oh yes. That's a very important dimension now. Again, I wrote another piece in 2020 during the pandemic, 2019, I think, about the potential of the space cooperation between India and the Middle Eastern countries or West Asian countries. Saudi, for one, is doing lots. They have created Saudi Space Agency in 2018, December. UAE has its USR Space Agency. And all of you, I think, are aware of this. Probe Mars and others, sending an astronaut from NASA. So they are looking for more collaborations. In that field, the Chinese are making some headway inside Saudi Arabia also in terms of joint launching of satellites and collaborations. Again, we have our own framework, official institutional framework being signed between ISRO and some of these space agencies of the respective West Asian countries. That area needs to be given a lot more push. There should be more visibility. We have our own mechanisms, working mechanisms with Israel. Oman showed some interest, quite a bit of interest to collaborate with us in that field between ISRO and the Omani Space Agency. So when you're talking about this Quad, mini Quad, and the prospects and opportunities for cooperation, space remains a very important domain where we could see where there should be more collaboration involving the Indian expertise in space and science and technology. And you have Israel also that has done some good work on their own space special area. And of course, you have the technological giant like the United States, and you have money in Saudi Arabia, you have money right in UAE to invest in those programs. So one would not be surprised if you are able to, because since we haven't started off, I would not be able to say that this is going to be the trend. But going by the logic of, looking at the the way we're told is that each one of these countries has. I'm positive to say that, you know, that there could be such collaboration in the near future.
All right, wonderful. I think we've covered plenty of different nuances with respect to India and West Asia. Thank you again, Dr. Nandarjan, for being on Bharat Vartha and also enlightening us on this very fascinating topic.
Thank you. Thank you, Roshan, for having me. I hope I have answered to some of your...
been a treat for the listeners.
Right. It's just to sum up, if I may, the upward trajectory is very visible in our relationship with West Asia, with West Asian countries. There are, I would say, no serious obstacles before us, as long as the region is not hit by a large conflict or something,
right,
which we could derail our economic projects, our human security could be at stake, and at the same time, their investments coming to us would be, derailed and distorted. There would be challenges, no relations isn't devoid of any challenges. There would be challenges from time to time. But given the nature, the existing nature of the relationship and the kind of, the meat that we have in this relationship is so strong and so, the substance, I would say. So it's again remains up to the Indian government to execute those agreements being signed and make it visible on the ground. Because otherwise, tomorrow there could be questions about where is the result, where are the results of this agreement or that agreement or the MOU being signed. So, but then I, as a watcher of the bilateral relationships and the regional politics, we are doing fairly well than how it used to be. And on this positive note, express my gratitude to you and Bharat Vartha for having me this afternoon to speak on the subject.
Right. Thanks. That's a great note to end the podcast on. Thank you so much again, Dr. Nandarjan, for making time for us. And hope the listeners have had their fair share of all of the news and all of the perspectives on this region. So thank you so much again.
Pleasure all mine, Roshan. Stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Vartha podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Vartha to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharat Vartha on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvartha.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.